않을까.
Welcome. Today is Wednesday, June the 8th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, America will have its first female presidential nominee.
We are all standing under a glass ceiling right now.
More Republican leaders slam Donald Trump as he claims his comments are misconstrued. Concerns over the possible reopening of a plutonium plant in North Korea. Even in death, Prince helping young people in Africa. Also ahead, the global impact of Muhammad Ali. It's all today on International Edition. Well, we begin with the U.S. presidential campaign. History is made in the United States. Voters cast ballots in six primaries Tuesday as Hillary Clinton secured the delegates needed to become the Democratic nominee. In a speech in Brooklyn, New York, Clinton reveled in the significance.
We've reached a milestone. The first time in our nation's history that a woman will be a major party's nominee.
Now, on the other side, there is continued turmoil as GOP leaders continue to rail against Donald Trump's comments about a Hispanic judge. Trump said last week he feels U.S. District Judge Gonzalo Curiel, because of his Mexican heritage, would not fairly rule in a case charging Trump with fraud. Now, Trump has refused to back off those statements, but he did give a campaign speech in New York Tuesday that aimed to unify.
My goal is always again to bring people together. But if I'm forced to fight for something I really care about, I will never, ever back down, and our country will never, ever back down.
Well, joining me now with the latest on this election year that is like no other, VOA national correspondent Jim Malone. Now, Jim, let's begin with the historic significance of the presumptive Democratic nominee, Hillary Clinton.
First of all, she noted the historic nature of what she's been able to achieve. She is the presumptive Democratic nominee, and she will be the first woman presidential nominee in American history. Think about this. As she even mentioned in her speech, women in the United States could only vote for president beginning in 1920. Here we are 96 years later, and for the first time, a major party presidential nominee will be a woman. So much as we talked about in 2008 with Barack Obama and his history-making run as the first African-American, for sure, Clinton has made history. Whether she can take it to the next step and become the first woman president, we don't know yet. But this is a major achievement in and of itself. The other thing she talked about, party unity, reaching out to Bernie Sanders followers, trying to set the stage to bring them on board, paying tribute to Sanders and what he's accomplished, but also urging the party to come together, and that's because they face a very potent adversary in Donald Trump. And she spent a fair bit of her speech as well talking about Donald Trump and comparing and contrasting not only their policies but their attitudes. And she concluded by saying basically her campaign is about bringing people together, whereas she believes Trump's idea is to build walls and to keep people apart.
Okay, so before we get to Donald Trump, Bernie Sanders, is he likely to get out at this point?
I think the longer it goes on, there'll be more pressure from Democratic leaders to get on board and kind of close ranks. Perhaps the biggest pressure will come in the end from President Barack Obama himself, who apparently already reached out to Sanders in a phone call over the weekend, and I think stands ready now probably to endorse Hillary Clinton. So we're going to see the process unfold over the next few weeks of the Democratic Party coming together and Clinton trying to get the party unified behind her to take on Trump.
Okay, so let's turn to Donald Trump. Just as the Democratic primaries are winding up, there is definitely turmoil within the Republican Party over Donald Trump's comments about a Hispanic judge. He's getting a lot of condemnation. What's the latest on that side?
You know, Trump gave a speech, a couple of things about it interesting. Number one, he used a teleprompter. He's fond of blasting Clinton for using a teleprompter and some of his other rivals. Obviously, that says he wanted to be more disciplined in what he had to say on Tuesday night. Much of what he had to say was a blast against Hillary Clinton and her husband, Bill Clinton, and he promised a speech next week to go into detail about various allegations of malfeasance that he believes the Clintons have committed over the years. So that was one aspect of what he talked about. But he did not directly address the situation with his comments about the federal judge and his Mexican heritage. And this has sent the party into at least a short-term bout of turmoil right now. You have the Speaker of the House calling it the textbook definition of racism, that is Trump's comments about this judge. You have the Senate leader, Mitch McConnell, for the Republicans, saying he needs to stop it, stop insulting various ethnic groups, and stick to the major issues in the campaign. You have a senator from Illinois, Mark Kirk, who says he is now taking back his endorsement of Trump. The Republican Party continues to be in turmoil over Donald Trump.
He's made a lot of statements in the past year or so that many people thought would sink him for good, but instead it didn't at all, you know, and now he is the presumptive Republican nominee. Could this situation be the turning point for him in the wrong direction?
A lot of people are wondering about that. Some people sense that it could be different than the other incidents. For example, in her speech tonight, Hillary Clinton called Trump temperamentally unfit to be president. But the jury's out on this. And even if he does weather this particular controversy, I think there's just this grain of uncertainty in the minds of so many Republicans now. Can they trust this man down the line? And don't forget, we're talking about a 5-month campaign now. So there's this swirling uncertainty that has helped Trump in some ways rush through the primaries. Will it help him in the general election as well, or will it hurt him? And the jury's out on that.
All right. Thanks so much. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone. Now turning to what's trending online on social media with our social media reporter, G. Abby Lee. We're staying with U.S. politics. Hi, G.
Hi, G. Hi, Lori.
So we are talking about the big story today, of course, U.S. politics. Mm-hmm. What's trending?
The California primary is wrapping up, but people are talking about it even before Tuesday. Way ahead of the event, the AP reported Hillary Clinton to be the presumptive Democratic nominee and tweeted its announcement on the development. When you click on the link provided in the tweet, you can read the entire statement by its director of media relations, but it did say AP will not call her the nominee until next month. That's when the party's delegates formally cast their vote at the convention in Philadelphia.
Still, it's a big statement. It's a big breakthrough
right.
in U.S. politics. It's historic, really. What's the reaction like?
As you can imagine, this fueled strong reactions from both Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders' campaigns. On AP's Facebook post, Sanders supporters have copied and pasted activist Sean King's comment. As you know, he's one of the better-known Sanders supporters. And the comment is quite long, but here's the gist of it. With 6 states and D.C. remaining, more than 810 delegates are still outstanding. King also argued superdelegates do not count until July.
So what are Clinton and Sanders saying about it on Twitter?
Clinton was more prolific than usual on Twitter Tuesday and cautious about the AP story. She tweeted, "They still have work to do," and wrote, "Let's keep fighting for every vote." Sanders, for his part, tweeted, "Pundits and the political press want to call this race early before every person votes. Let's show them we're not going to let that happen. Go vote." That's all for me today. Lori?
All right. Thanks so much, G. You can follow her at G. Abby Lee and myself at Lori London. That's London with a U. Here are some of the other stories we're following at VOAnews.com. Hundreds of Afghans attend the funeral of a slain NPR journalist. Islamic State is attracting rising numbers of Balkan youth. Syria's President Bashar Assad vows victory against outside foes. The U.S. Speaker of the House unveils a plan to fight poverty, and Minnesotans honor a native son on Prince Day. You can find expanded coverage of these stories and lots more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. A big climate announcement could come this week in Washington. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi is on a state visit to the United States. And in a meeting Tuesday at the White House, he expressed support for the enactment of the Paris Climate Agreement this year. If India ratifies the deal, that will put it on the brink of going into force well ahead of the original 2020 target.
In Paris, the joining of forces between India and the United States helped forge a historic agreement that can effectively deal with climate change. And we discussed how we can, as quickly as possible, bring the Paris Agreement into force.
Well, critics note that India has committed to very little under the Paris Agreement. They say much more will be needed from India and the rest of the world to keep the planet below the 2-degree threshold that scientists consider critical to the well-being of the Earth. You can read more on the story at voanews.com. The International Atomic Energy Agency, the UN's nuclear watchdog, says North Korea appears to have reopened a plant to reprocess plutonium, an indication the country's widening its arms effort. Let's talk more about this with our Southeast Asia Bureau Chief, Steve Herman. Steve, what do we know at this point?
Well, we're not only hearing now that they have reopened this facility, but actually that production of reprocessing plutonium has started. In other words, that North Korea is again, according to both U.S. and U.N. sources, has restarted production of plutonium fuel. Now, this is big news, but I wouldn't say that this is necessarily surprising news, because North Korea vowed 3 years ago to restart all of its nuclear facilities, including its main reactor and a smaller plant at Yongbyon, where this reprocessing now is apparently taking place again. It had shut this down in 2007 as part of an international deal where for shutting down these facilities it would get some aid, but that deal later collapsed. And there had been much anticipation and rhetoric from North Korea that it would go again in this direction.
So what does this mean specifically for North Korea's nuclear ambitions going forward?
Well, if you talk to the experts and the analysts who study this, and no one knows, of course, certain numbers, but it's believed that North Korea has a stockpile of somewhere around a dozen, perhaps as many as 16, 17 bombs. And with this reprocessing, obviously they're going to be able to ramp that up. And combined with their ballistic missile program, of course, if they're able not only to have these bombs, but able to miniaturize them, and that is very difficult to do. If they're able to do that and then mount a nuclear weapon on top of a ballistic missile, it makes them a much, much more dangerous threat to its neighbors, even to the United States, because it has already demonstrated that it has missiles that can reach as far, perhaps, as Guam or Hawaii, and they're a full bore with their intentions and everything that they've been doing also publicly to try to be able to get a ballistic missile put together that can go across the Pacific Ocean.
Have any of North Korea's neighbors commented on these revelations as of yet?
There have been constant comments from both South Korea and Japan and warnings that North Korea should not continue to proceed with its nuclear and ballistic missile program, and warnings of further isolation. Those warnings have fallen on deaf ears in Pyongyang so far. We haven't had any specific fresh reaction to the reports now that reprocessing has apparently begun again, but we can expect some very harsh rhetoric coming from Park Geun-hye in Seoul and Shinzo Abe in Tokyo within the hours, if not days.
Is there anything that the outside world can do at this point?
We put on North Korea. There have been many UN resolutions passed. It is under all sorts of international sanctions. It is being more tightly squeezed. The key, according to almost everybody who studies this, is really how much is China willing to squeeze North Korea? If the Chinese really want to crack down on Pyongyang, most of the analysts believe that that is what could be most effective. Of course, it is clear that the Chinese do not want the North Korean government to collapse, no matter how uncomfortable and how upset it also makes leaders in Beijing, because they worry, in their eyes, about a far greater geostrategic problem, which would be the fear that not only would there be chaos and possibly an influx of refugees fleeing into China, but also the fact that South Korea and the United States might move into North Korea and basically making the U.S. and the South Koreans have a stronger military position on the Korean Peninsula. So it remains to be seen just how far the Chinese in the months and years ahead are going to be willing to let this go.
And you can read more about this story at voanews.com. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
News happens around the clock. And VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palkov.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock on the Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. Tuesday would have been Prince's birthday. What someone close to him is doing now to carry on his legacy. But first, Muhammad Ali, not only boxing's world heavyweight champ, but also known for his activism outside the ring. Ali, who was born Cassius Clay, died last week at the age of 74. He will be remembered internationally with many dignitaries expected to attend his funeral Friday. VOA's Carolyn Prasuti explains why this sports icon's popularity extended far beyond the boundaries of the United States.
Before a fight, Muhammad Ali could be a braggart.
And the world will bow and admit that I am the greatest of all times.
During the fight, he could be a showman. Colorful and controversial. He took his boxing global. In Africa for his rumble in the jungle with fellow American George Foreman. In the Philippines for the Thrilla in Manila against Joe Frazier.
When I was a child in Afghanistan, I heard about him, and everybody wanted to be Ali in his school.
Muhammad Ali had 56 wins and 5 losses, but not everyone knows of his diplomatic record outside the ring. In 1985, Ali flew to Lebanon, but failed to get hostages freed from a hijacking. 5 years later, during the Gulf War, he met with Iraq's Saddam Hussein and brought 15 American hostages home. Tributes keep pouring in to Ali's hometown of Louisville, Kentucky, where Imam Zaid Shakir will lead a prayer and memorial service. He says Ali became an international name after he refused a fight in the Vietnam War and was stripped of his heavyweight title. Imam Shakir spoke via Skype.
He could have the cars and the homes and the yachts and the money and the limelight, and he gave all of that up to take a principled stand in defense of the weak and downtrodden.
Attending Friday's funeral, several heads of state, including Jordan's King Abdullah and Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. No surprise to the owner of this boutique.
He was very popular, and me and my age, we all grew up with him. We watch his games, and we know him very well.
No one knows that better than Ali's daughter, Layla.
This man transcends everything there is, and everybody just loves him, you know. So there isn't anybody else like him. I don't think there ever will be.
Muhammad Ali leaves a legacy extending across the globe. And this quote of his speaks to all of us. Live every day as if it were your last, because someday you're going to be right. Ali's someday was last Friday. Carolyn Pursuti, VOA News, Washington.
I'm the greatest, and I'm knocking out all bones. And if you get too small, I'll knock you out.
This is what it sounds like when the doves cry.
Now another icon, a musical icon. Tuesday would have been superstar Prince's 58th birthday, and it's still hard to believe he's gone. Another amazing talent taken far too soon. And while Prince was known for his amazing talent, he was also known for his giving spirit. And we are now learning from Entertainment Tonight senior editor Jennifer Parros that his charitable legacy will live on. Jen, what can you tell us?
Some really nice news coming from his ex-wife, Manuela Testolini. She actually shared with us today exclusively that she is going to be building a school in Malawi in the late singer's honor. She told Entertainment Tonight, Prince wanted to change lives, especially those of impoverished children. Malawi is one of the 20 least developed countries in the world, and most Malawian children, particularly girls, do not have access to education. Constructing a school here means lifting an entire community and breaking the cycle of poverty. And she really wants the school to be a reflection of his charitable spirit. Of course, Prince was known as giving back to the music community, and especially the community in his hometown of Chanhassen, Minnesota. And she really wants his legacy to go on as just being an activist and somebody who helps, especially children in need. She really does hope that a lot of people do benefit out of this and just remember who Prince was.
Wow, that's fantastic. Was this something that was in the works before, or is this because of his passing?
She had actually told us right before his death, though, 2 months ago, that she reached out to him to let him know that she was thinking of building a school. And then, of course, a couple days later, he tragically passed away at the sudden age of 57. And she thought, you know what, I'm going to do it now in his honor. And her heart just broke at the thought that he wouldn't be able to enjoy it and see it. So she is her foundation, In a Perfect World, an organization that Prince had definitely helped out for years after their marriage. They are going to be spearheading this, and she already funds the construction of 23 schools all over Africa, Nepal, Haiti, Mali, and Nicaragua. So this is a woman who really has done so much for years and is now doing it in the legacy of her ex-husband.
Is this the ex-wife of Prince's that he remained very in love with?
Yes, Emanuela is somebody who's known as Prince's great love. And even after their divorce, they did still stay close friends. And she spoke to him just a couple days before his death. So this is someone that was really special to Prince and somebody who really knew what he wanted. So this isn't a person who's taking money and kind of building something for, you know, an unjust cause. She really is doing this in his honor.
The first since the death of his daughter.
This is Bobby Brown's first sit-down interview with anybody, and the first time that he's really opening up after the death of his daughter, Bobby Christina, who, of course, is the daughter that he had with the late singer Whitney Houston. And Bobby Brown, who really has always been known as being this bad boy, druggy addict of the music industry, and who people really blamed for the death of his ex-wife and daughter. And this is the first time that Bobby really opens up, gets emotional. We actually spoke to Robin Roberts Tuesday morning in New York City, and she really told us, you know, it was tough because this man, and you can see how emotional he gets and how hurt he was by the loss of his daughter. And Robin said, you know, it pained me to just ask him all these questions, but I'm a journalist, and I had to do it, and there were so many questions that people still have. And of course, I'm sure everybody remembers that Bobby Christina was found of a drug overdose in the bathtub of her home in January of 2015. And eerily, it was the exact way that her mother, Whitney Houston, was found dead. And Bobby really says, you know, listen, I knew that I know now that I could have done a lot more to protect Bobby Christina. He said putting her in the middle of a reality show at the age of 11 is something that he regrets now and something he wishes he could take back. So, yeah, it's pretty telling. It's a very interesting interview. He definitely does touch on the Nick Gordon side of this. Of course, Nick Gordon was Bobby Christina's boyfriend at the time of her death. Nick Gordon was actually also somebody who Whitney Houston had unofficially adopted at the age of 12. So Bobby said, listen, the only person that knows exactly who killed Whitney and Bobby Christina is Nick Gordon, and I will never get those answers again. So definitely a compelling interview done by Robin Roberts that you can catch on ABC.com.
All right. Thanks so much. Entertainment Tonight senior news editor Jennifer Perros. You've been listening to International Edition. We will be back tomorrow at the same time, same place. You can always find us online at voanews.com and follow us on Twitter at @VOA_IE. Thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, has granted KSH 380 million to Kenyan innovators as part of its Feed the Future Kenya Innovation Engine, or KIE, an effort to reward and improve agriculture-based innovations. To date, more than 57,000 rural households have benefited from KIE-supported innovations and attracted nearly $1.4 million in public and private sector investment. At a launch held May 31st in Nairobi, the agency granted funds to 10 local firms to transform simple agriculture initiatives into valuable projects in Kenya. Such projects have played key roles in improving incomes in individual households, while at the same time reducing poverty levels and improving food security among communities. Following a vetting process, six of these pilot rollout grants have already been awarded, and the Innovation Engine is poised to grant funding and technical assistance to an additional four advanced innovations, said Karen Freeman, the Mission Director, USAID Kenya and East Africa. Kenya Innovation Engine is a five-year program implemented in collaboration with USAID partner Land O'Lakes International Development that identifies, nurtures, and brings to scale innovative, private sector-oriented solutions to food security, undernutrition, and poverty. The Innovation Engine collaborates with entrepreneurs who design new concepts, products, and services to maximize their commercial value. The initiative was launched in 2012 with funding from USAID. Kenya Innovation Engine has so far provided seed funding and technical expertise to 22 innovations with a promise of more support for food security and social support initiatives. This initiative has contributed substantively to building the businesses and institutions involved in these areas, said Ms. Freeman. Among the benefits achieved by the initiative, more than 57,000 households reached by new technologies during the proof-of-concept stage, 30,000 farmers made a repeat purchase of the innovation. Smallholders have recorded $6.7 million in incremental sales since adopting these innovations, and enterprises created 1,458 jobs at the proof-of-concept innovation testing stage. The United States is proud to work with its partner Kenya to improve agriculture for the benefit of Kenyans and the Africa region.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. We'll be right back.
is for, what's your